ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
At one point in time there in the late 80s, early 90s, the Bronx, New York district, Southern District in New York, was number one in the country for crack cocaine arrests, prosecutions, and incarcerations. The Southern District of West Virginia was number two in the country. We were doing so many people. I mean, we had the Kanawha County Jail full, the Putnam County Jail full, Boone County Jail, Logan County Jail, full of federal prisoners. In fact, we were taking people. If we made arrests at night on crack cocaine charges, especially if they were out-of-staters, we would call the marshals. Sometimes we'd have to take people over into Kentucky and lodge them in jail before the marshals could come and get them for the hearing the next day. There were so many.
Wow.
There was so much crack going on in town.
Hey, gang, welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murphy in the Morning. My guest this week is a retired Charleston, West Virginia police officer named Terry Sayer. Terry was a 25-year veteran of the Charleston Police Department, spent about 19 of those years working narcotics. This was back in the, I started in law enforcement in 75, Terry started in 72. So we're going back a ways, but this is when cocaine was really starting to blow up in communities. I'm down in Bluefield, West Virginia, population less than 20,000. Terry's up in Charleston, West Virginia. At that time, population roughly 100,000. But just because these were small communities didn't mean that cocaine still didn't come in and scar our communities. So we're kind of talking about how that all came about. He's got a new book out called Snowstorm. I showed this to you yesterday. There will be a link at the end of the show where you can find this, or you can go to the gameofcrimes.com website. Click on the link there. It'll take you to Amazon where you can order his book. Terry was nice enough to send me an autographed copy. And these are keepsakes for me. You folks can see, I don't know if you can see, but these bookshelves behind me are full of books. I didn't read this much in college. But this book, I read in about a total of probably 5 or 6 hours on a plane flying from Orlando up to Washington, D.C. and then back. That's how good a book it is. If you're wondering how drug cases were made by undercover police officers back in the 80s and 90s, before we had all this modern technology that we have out here today, it's right there in the book. So we're going to get into some more of the stuff that he did, but also we're going to get into some of the politics that he ran into during that time. So having said all that, Terry, welcome back to the show, brother.
Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, Terry. You and I understand each other perfectly. We may have to get an interpreter for some of the folks out there because they might not understand our accents.
Well, that can happen. That happens when you go different places. And my accent usually doesn't fit in above the Mason-Dixon line at all. So,
well, that's when people tell me I have an accent. I'm like, no, I don't. You have an accent.
Yeah, you have the problem.
That's it. So let's just kick right back in where we were yesterday. We talked a little bit about informants. So what's a common way that you recruit these informants, and how far can you trust them?
Well, to answer the last question first, you can never trust them.
There you go.
Never. I had a couple different informants that probably worked for me for 15 years, but you still can never trust them totally. They always, you had to look at what their motivation was. I found later on, starting out, usually you end up with, always ended up with criminal informants. You never got your informants from any place good because you needed somebody who was living in the drug world. So the ones that get paid, the mercenaries, usually turn out to be the best. Most times, unfortunately, that's just the nature of the beast, or somebody that's just newly arrested at wants to work their way out of a jam. Those are pretty good sometimes. But you always had to make sure, verify everything they told you was the truth, and just not believe them 100%. Never, ever. Couldn't do it.
And what did you find that as these informants are going in initially, your goal is to introduce an undercover police officer so you can cut the informant out? Is that what your goal was?
Yeah, that's always your long-term goal if you can achieve it. Sometimes it was harder than others, but it always comes down to the money. The drug dealers will do whatever. It's all, they have a product that's useless unless they can turn it into cash. So if you're the guy controlling the money, then they'll meet you eventually and do the deal.
Did you ever, working undercover, did you ever walk away from a drug deal?
A couple. I had a couple guys that several guys that worked for me in the past that would get mad at me because I'd say, that's a robbery. That's not a drug deal. They're just trying to set you up for a robbery. And they'd get mad at me and scream and holler, and we'd have a back and forth. And I'd be like, well, just walk away from them. We're not going to do it. And then 6 months later, we would end up getting the suspect through another person. We'd interview him. We're like, what about that deal you were going to do with those guys in the past? He said, most times they'd say, oh, hell, I was going to rob those guys. I was going to try to take their money. So if it doesn't feel right, and you just don't do it. If you have that sixth sense that tells you that this is a bad deal, this is not a good thing, you're not in control. If you don't feel like you're in control, then you better look over your shoulder, be looking for some people that you don't see.
Words of wisdom there. I mean, from that, ladies and gentlemen, that's from an expert who has 19 years working undercover narcotics. Well, my experience with drug deals and not just me working undercover, I never did any long-term. It was only short-term undercover. But on my deals and other law enforcement officers' deals, when things didn't go, because you want to maintain control, even though you're making them believe they're in control, when they want to change things on you, just say, deal's off. Yeah. And they'll follow you wanting to do that. They might not do it immediately, but they'll contact you later and still want to do the deal. Because I think an undercover cop would never walk away from it.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's what I told my guys most times, that the police will wait forever. Most people wouldn't wait forever for a deal to happen. And the police will wait forever. And if you're one of those people that will wait forever, then people are smart enough to figure out you're not who they think you are.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Now, so when you guys, back when you were doing your surveillances and so forth, you didn't have the benefit of GPS back then, did you?
No, we just had people surveillance. That was it. We had, at the end, we got those cameras that you put in electric transformers on pole cameras, they were called. We had a couple of those at the very end of my career. But all that stuff was starting to come online then. We did have a few trackers that you could put on vehicles to follow people sometimes. We use those occasionally, but had to be careful not to lose the tracker or whatever, because in Kanawha County, Kanawha Valley, the signal was bouncing off the mountains. So sometimes when you get a true reading on the machine, it's where they're located, the signal be bouncing around. So sometimes those were useful, sometimes they weren't.
Yeah. You guys must have been really good at surveillance. And it sounded like, and I'm basing this on your book, what I read in here, it sounded like you always had plenty of units out there to conduct surveillance. Because sometimes you got to split surveillances because you want to see what this person and what that person are doing. Is that true?
Yeah, we were. Like I said earlier, we had good working relationships with the DEA and ATF and others. So we always had plenty of vehicles. Everybody had their own car. Sometimes we partner up, sometimes we wouldn't. But, we did have a look-alike taxi cab back in the day. We had the police mechanic take one of the old cruisers that was the same model as the local taxi service. And we got with the taxi service, put a taxi meter in there, got the lighting, got the light put on top, got all the markings, got it painted. It was a replica taxi. You couldn't tell the difference. Sometimes the undercover guy would ride around drug dealers, pick them up, but it was a perfect vehicle to use downtown for surveillance. It was really good.
Oh, yeah. Did you guys ever get burned on surveillance?
Every time. Not every time, but yeah, it happens. Some people get too overzealous and don't trust what somebody just told them. Some people have to see it all for themselves, and you got to trust whatever somebody else tells you. If your partner says you got to turn right on this certain street, well, you know they turned right. You don't have to. Not everybody needs to go see it. So you just always had to make sure you just had one person on the point and everybody else, somebody was ahead of the bad guy, or let them follow you. Nobody looked ahead. I always found out that if you were doing a big deal and you flashed them $100,000, and once they saw the cash, I always said they got brain locked. You could follow them with a marked cruiser and they wouldn't see the police because they didn't want to see the police.
Right.
You know, they wanted to believe. Once they saw the large amount of money, they want to believe that you are who you say you are.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I keep smiling here is when I was in Miami, we were doing a 400 kilo cocaine deal. We already had picked up the dope down in the Turks and Caicos Islands, and we're following this lady around. And one of our senior agents was an unbelievable undercover agent. And that was his gift. But he should have just left it at that, because when it came to surveillance, I mean, you talk about bumper locking, he would continually be the first car right behind the suspect car. We're following this woman around and she goes into a business, and we kept telling him on the radio, back off. We've got cars on both ends of the street. So when she came out, she has to pass one of us. And sure enough, he's like, I'm gonna go see what's going on. He drives down the street. Well, she comes out about that time, steps out in front of his car, makes him stop, and then comes up to his driver's window. It's like, I want to know why you're following me and who you are. I mean, that's how bad it was. But because of his experience undercover, he had the gift of gab. And he's like, I mean, he could come up with a lie just like that. He said, oh, baby, I saw you earlier. You were so fine looking. I thought there was going to be an opportunity for me to meet you. And just, he put a line of crap on her and she fell for it.
Well, there you go. She wanted to believe.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's unbelievable. We ended up locking everybody up eventually, and all was well. But in your book, it seemed to me that every time you put a hidden microphone, or kill unit, whatever you call it, on either the agent or the informant, it worked. Did it always work for you guys?
No. So sometimes it would work. They could be having a conversation about sports, and as soon as the conversation turned to drugs, sometimes the kill unit just go bad. The batteries would die, or the reception would be bad all of a sudden, or somebody would turn on a television. Or we had one guy that did an undercover deal in a bar down in South Charleston. He went in, he was wearing a wire, and as soon as he get near the jukebox, all of his conversations was coming out of the jukebox. That's how crazy it was. And everybody in the bar was looking around, trying to figure out where the conversation's coming from. So,
did he pick up on that?
He picked up on that. He got out of there right away. But it was pretty bizarre because everybody was like, where's that coming from? Where's that conversation? How's that getting in the jukebox? I don't know what the frequency was or how that anomaly happened, but it just happened. It was just one of them crazy evenings.
Oh, that's hilarious. It's hilarious now.
Now that nobody got hurt, it was. Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's get into something that I try to avoid here on the show, and that's the topic of politics. And we're not going to talk about politics, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about politicians a little bit, because you had a few challenges there, didn't you? I'll just ask you, did you ever have any dealings with politicians there in Charleston or Kanawha County or the state of West Virginia that involved politicians?
Oh, absolutely. We had the prosecuting attorney for Kanawha County that I was a member of the FOP. I was a big supporter. I was a longtime officer in the FOP. And we had a problem with the local prosecutor. He was, we could get somebody for selling heroin, and he'd cut the case down to possession of marijuana. He was selling heroin to having 20 grams of pot or 15 grams of pot or something. So we weren't happy with him, and he made the local newspaper upset. So there was a guy came in from out of state that used to be from Kanawha County, Mike Rourke, and he ran for prosecuting attorney. So we got behind him. We supported him. We were friends with him. We helped him get elected prosecuting attorney. He hired some of the best assistants in his office that we ever worked with. He turned that whole office around. Then later on, his big thing was to go out on drug deals and drug busts with us and get his picture in the paper or get on the television. And he was a big rah-rah anti-drug guy. He ran on that. He was running for another term. I mean, he was very popular in Kanawha County. Everybody loved him. He went out on one drug deal with us where we had busted these two guys from out of state at the local hotel. And they had about a pound of coke, 1,000 Dilaudid pills, and of course they were armed. And they had a little small 1 gram vial of cocaine as a sample of their coke that we tested and arrested them and took them to the police station for processing. And after they tried to pull a gun on me and my partner, but anyway, that worked out. So anyway, the prosecutor got his picture made with all the evidence that was, we put it on the trunk of a police car behind the station that morning. We'd been out all night and the vial of coke, everything was in the picture. And then he rode to magistrate court with me and my partner, Larry. And we got to back, on the way there, he wanted to see the evidence. We handed out a paper bag and I handed him the evidence in the back seat and I could hear the bag rustle and he got me open and he gave me the bag back later and then locked it in the trunk. We went in for the preliminary hearing. They were held without bond. And then we all went home, took a shower. Came back to Bourke later that day to process the evidence, take to state police lab, and lo and behold, the 1 gram vial of cocaine is missing from the bag. So we take the car apart, take the trunk apart, go to the newspaper and get pictures of him with the drugs, the vial of coke's in the picture. So it disappeared somewhere between there and the trunk of our vehicle. So we sat around that evening and commiserated and finally came to the conclusion that he probably stole that vial of coke from us. That was our first inkling that he was involved in drugs.
That's your prosecutor.
That was the prosecuting attorney for Kanawha County. Yeah, the one was one of the best at that time. Yes, sir. That was very disappointing. And just being regular cops, we really didn't know what to think.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here? Because we saw the other side where he had a lot of assistants that were kicking butt on all our cases and working with us. But people can be two or three different things to two or three different people. So he had a problem. And then he ran for mayor later on. He decided to run for mayor of Charleston. So before the election, there was one of my friends was a chief. He got fired. The mayor at that time appointed one of the captains to be the interim chief. They didn't like the prosecutor. They wanted to keep the current mayor. So anyway, they found out about the missing vial of coke, and me and my buddy get called down to the mayor's office, and he just rips us, wanting us to go to magistrate court. This is the afternoon. A Monday afternoon before an election on Tuesday. And okay. he tells the interim chief, tell these two detectives to go to magistrate court and sign a warrant for the county prosecutor. And I'm like, I'm not signing a warrant for the county prosecutor just on this. So we go back and forth for a couple hours. He's cussing us and we're, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full. Finally, he just gets up. He says, when I get reelected tomorrow, get elected mayor again tomorrow, I'm firing you two guys. We're like, okay, what are you going to say? You can't do anything about it, right? So we go back to office and we're like, tell the guys there what's going on. Everybody's like, hey, let's get some beer and think it's over. So anyway, that night, somebody stole all the mayor's campaign signs. I don't know who did, but somebody stole all the mayor's campaign signs in the city of Charleston. And he loses the election. So being the typical smart asses that we were at that time, we go by his campaign quarters to see him, see how he's doing. And he didn't like that. He had a few remarks for us and we had a few remarks for him. But then the prosecutor who we helped get elected, who stole the coke, he's the new mayor.
Oh, geez.
So that's just how it happens. And then later on, we end up working the case on him.
Jeez. Well, and that's a question I got for you later, but since we're here, I want to ask you, he was eventually indicted federally. Was it 5 felonies and 25 misdemeanors.
Yeah, there was a bunch. Yeah, there was a lot of charges.
But then when he got his plea agreement, what did he plead guilty to?
2 or 3 misdemeanors.
How does that happen? I mean, I know how it happens, but.
You know how it happens. I mean, they wanted it to go away. I mean, the FBI, that's the only case we ever worked with the FBI was that task force that was set up after we did the Huntington case down there with the FBI. Excuse me. They went to the U.S. Attorney's Office and got them geared up on the mayor. Of course, it was put out under the auspices of let's get some people that has money. Let's get some different people. Don't get some street people. Let's get some people that have power and influence. So we saw it as an opportunity to get some people we would never have an opportunity to get. They saw it as an opportunity to get the mayor. Of course, they're all going to get promoted and bonuses and all that good stuff, whatever federal agents get for that. And so they used us, we used them. It was like the song said, and neither one cared. So anyway, we did our thing. They did their thing, and it all worked out, I guess.
So at one point in the book, you talk about receiving what we call a target letter. So would you mind explaining, just give us the Reader's Digest version of what a targeting letter is and why you got one?
Yeah, absolutely. In the middle of all this, the new sheriff of the county was accused of doing some drugs too. So he was smarter than the mayor. He goes and gets him a lawyer and cuts a deal. He gets immunity. So he or she gets immunity, I'll just put it that way. And then, so he goes to see the FBI and they debrief him, take a statement. And one of the DEA guys is there for the statement. So Jerry Reinhart calls me one day, says, "Hey, come over to the office." I go over there and then he said, here's a statement of the sheriff. And I'm like, okay, well, how'd you get that? Well, he cut a deal. We're like, we don't like him, but what are you going to do about it? You just say, okay, we'll go along with it. So I go back, create a file, put that in there. And the current mayor's chief calls me and says, I want a copy of that. So anyway, he sends a guy up and gets a copy of it. Next thing you know, it makes it to the newspaper. And of course, one of the guys that works that task force and myself get target letters to try to find out what happened to how they got to the newspaper.
And what is a target letter?
It just basically says you're the subject of an investigation by the federal government, the U.S. Attorney's Office. They actually brought in a lawyer from Maine Justice to do this because we work with everybody in their office.
Right.
So they brought a different lawyer in from that. So me and my partner go get lawyers and end up at the U.S. Attorney's Office being interviewed by this person from Maine Justice about what happened to the interview. It wasn't 6E grand jury material. It was a report of investigation. So anyway, we have a couple meetings over there. They threaten to put us in jail if we don't tell them this or that. And we're like, well, you give us total immunity, we'll tell you everything. And it went back and forth 2 or 3 times. And then finally, it just went away. Out of the clear blue one day, it just went away. And then we're all back to working cases with the U.S. Attorney's Office again. So somebody made it go away. I don't know. I guess they decided we weren't worth leaning on. But believe me, it was very stressful for me at that point in time. I mean, this whole thing was nothing but a lot of stress from the very beginning, from the Missing Valley Code to the next mayor election to the mayor going to jail, to the sheriff being investigated. It was like I was the monkey in the middle all the time, getting pulled in 10 different directions.
To the chief continually browbeating you and.
Yeah, he was edgy. He didn't want to lose that job. He had landed the job he loved more than life. And he was actually a friend. And, but he was loyal to a fault to the mayor. And I think he was more upset about losing his position than he was what was happening to the mayor in the scheme of things. And that's life. I understand that to a certain degree. But I didn't need any more stress. I'll just put it that way. I had plenty at that point in time in my life. It was hard to handle sometimes, really.
Yeah.
Doing right's not easy.
No, it's
not. Doing the right thing's not easy all the time.
Especially when your so-called leaders don't have your back.
Correct. I had one chief that quit on me. I told him what was going on on a Monday, and he quit on Friday. So, I mean, that's just what you're going to do.
He didn't want that stress either.
No, he took the easy way out. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't quit. I didn't have my time in. So
yeah.
I was doing the life sentence here.
Sometimes it does feel like that, doesn't it?
There's points in time. Yeah, I did. Days were long.
You made reference to 6E material. Ladies and gentlemen, that's grand jury testimony, which is confidential. It's non-discoverable. And that's a big deal. If grand jury information is leaked outside of the grand jury, that's a really, really big deal. That's a criminal offense. But you talk about the report of investigation. The security classification of that typically in the feds is law enforcement sensitive. So it's not something that you want to get out there, but it's not illegal to share it with other agencies. So just to clear that up there a little bit, what a horrible thing to go through. I mean, we used to send targeting letters, but I've never been the recipient of one.
Well, that was the first for me and my buddy. It was just stress every day till that was resolved. And I think that was the whole point of dragging it out was to see when we would throw in the towel. But we're pretty hard-headed. We hadn't done anything, so I didn't. If I'd have done something, I would have owned up to it. I'm that kind of person. I've made plenty of mistakes in my life, and I've tried to own up to every one of them. And not this one. I didn't own this one, so I wasn't going to claim it.
Good for you. That's called standing up for your principles and your standards.
Yeah, you have to sometimes, especially if you don't have anybody else that's going to do it.
Yeah,
with you.
And there's that word. What's that word? Integrity. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a word sometimes. It's tough. You don't get any more pay for it.
Yeah.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casinos, the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the violence in Charleston really escalated when crack cocaine came on the scene. Were you guys prosecuting a lot of cases federally under those guidelines?
I tell you, we were prosecuting all the crack cases in federal court. Mike Carey was a U.S. attorney. He's probably one of the best that I ever worked with. He had some great assistants over there. Nancy Hill, she's deceased now, but she was great. Jack Kessler, Kurt Brampus, all Mike Callahan, all those people were really great. But yeah, he agreed to take all of our crack cases. And at one point in time, I know you might find this hard to believe, but this is the truth. At one point in time there in the late 80s, early 90s, the Bronx, New York district, Southern District in New York, was number one in the country for crack cocaine arrests, prosecutions, and incarcerations. The Southern District of West Virginia was number two in the country.
Wow.
We were doing so many people. I mean, we had the Kanawha County Jail full, the Putnam County Jail full, Boone County Jail, Logan County Jail, full of federal prisoners. In fact, we were taking people, if we made arrests at night on crack cocaine charges, especially if they were out of staters, we would call the marshals. Sometimes we'd have to take people over into Kentucky and lodge them in jail before the marshals could come and get them for the hearing the next day. There were so many.
Wow.
There was so much crack going on in town.
And that's not a convenient drive, is it?
No, me and my partner took two guys from New York to the Logan County Jail one Friday night. I think there were three of them. We had them in the paddy wagon, and Charleston had two paddy wagons, so we took one of them. And we were talking on the way down, if they knew where they were going to the Logan County Jail, we'd have had to kill them to get them in that wagon.
Yeah,
because that is definitely a change of culture from New York City to Logan County Jail, believe me. It's a change of culture for me, being from Charleston, going to the Logan County Jail. And these guys didn't know what they were in for.
That's when I was a railroad cop, when the coal miners were going to strike, the coal mine owners had contracts, and the railroad had to honor the contracts to pull coal. And so they'd send, I don't know, back then I think we had 600 railroad police around the country, so they'd take 100 of us and send us down there. And man, honestly, it was like going back in time.
Sir.
So was there ever a point in your career where you felt like, I mean, you've seen so much, everything from street dealers to victims of overdoses to politicians just looking out for themselves and violating the law. Did you ever have that feeling that maybe just this war on drugs is lost? There's no way we could ever win this?
I don't think I ever did. Maybe I should have, but we were all so focused on living that life every day that we were in our own bubble. I don't know, but we just were determined to do our part. That's all I could say. Some days you do, maybe one week you do two or three indoor grows, which indoor marijuana grows, which were big, big money cases. And then you get back, go right back to crack or the cocaine powder cases. But it just varied so much from time to time that we just did different stuff. We had the home invasion crews. We ended up getting two or three different home invasion crews that were putting on police raid jackets and wearing ski masks and impersonating police officers and going and robbing drug dealers, supermarkets. We got a couple of those. Those people were dangerous. I mean, very dangerous. They had no fear. If you go break in on drug dealers with and impersonate policemen, so getting those people, those are fun. Those are fun cases in a way. I know they were dangerous when you took them off, they arrested them, but it was just a fun, different diversion as having the regular humdrum of getting an informant and buying drugs every day. You investigate these guys was just a different thing. So we look forward to that type stuff, really.
Yeah. Well, it's called professionalism. I mean, it's you took an oath to try to protect and defend the citizens of the United States, and especially your community. And yeah, it's easy to get this feeling sorry for yourself, and whether people call it burnout or whatever you call it. But then something for me personally, and it only happened once. And then you see that I was in Colombia and you saw some of your colleagues come back in body bags, and it brings you back to reality. And honestly, we used to, you know how police humor can get a little dark at times. We used to say we had the best job security in the world. Still,
we didn't have a lot of people volunteering to work drug cases. So I guess that's why I ended up there so long, because we never had a plethora of people wanting to come there because of the inherent danger. Sometimes I thought, I know sometimes, unfortunately, the chief of police would give you what I'd say he'd give you somebody. It'd be one of his drinking buddies or one of his friends of a friend that thought they'd want to come work drugs, thought it'd be glamorous. And it didn't turn out to be what they thought it would be. The first guy that one of the chiefs gave me, well, we put him undercover the first week, and a guy pulled a gun, tried to shoot him in the head. That was on Friday. So he comes in on Monday, said, "Terry, I don't think this is for me up here." He said, you guys are going to get hurt. He said, "Somebody can get hurt up here." I told him, "Yeah, you can get hurt up here. It's not that hard." So anyway, those kind of people took care of themselves. They weeded themselves out. So, but you were talking earlier, you had to motivate yourself every day. You certainly didn't have people at the police department. Most of them didn't even know what you were doing half the time. Mm-hmm. So you had to motivate yourself every day and be self-motivated. And I was fortunate to have all people work for me were all like that. I didn't have to drag anybody down the road. Sometimes I had to slow some of them down for our own good.
Challenge of being a supervisor.
Yeah, you can only do so many cases in a day, and sometimes you got to take a pause for the calls there.
Yep. Did you ever have a particular case that you feel like changed you, that just impacted you to the point where it's like, wow?
Well, it wasn't my case, but I had a terrible situation where my stepson was shot and killed by a crack dealer, and that impacted me very bad. That was That was May 22nd, 1992. That was a terrible situation, and that impacted me for a while. It took it's hard to get over that, very hard. I don't know if you ever get over that, really, to be honest with you. But yeah, it was hard. That was a hard time. That was a hard time in my life, a hard time in everybody's life.
Did that secure your resolve to continue in narcotics? Because now that, I mean, it's actually touched you personally.
I guess it did. I stayed another 3 or 4 years there after that. So I determined it wasn't going to run me off. So I guess I must be a big hard-headed person. So I decided that I wasn't going to quit. Nothing was going to make me quit.
What I say is that DEA never hired me because I was real smart.
Well, I mean, you get locked into it. It's just it's a lifestyle. It's just who you are. It becomes who you are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It'll happen.
So just, I want to mention your book here. And ladies and gentlemen, here again is the book, Snowstorm. You can find this on any of the major outlets. I saw it on Amazon. I saw it on Books A Million, and I'll mention those at the end of today's episode. But I want to just talk about this. Why did you decide to write this book? What was the motivating factor?
I think the motivating factor for writing the book was my family, my wife, Linda, and my son, Denny, and my other son, Philip. I mean, I've told them we'd be riding around doing this or just talking, and I would tell them police stories after story, different stories, and they'd all be like, well, you need to write a book. My wife would be like, you need to write a book. You need to write a book. My sons would be like, you need to write a book. A couple of my friends, a guy in the neighborhood here, Matt, I bicycle with, and we go bicycle for 2 hours. So I'd tell him all kinds of police lies. And anyway, he's like, you ought to write a book. So finally, I sat down one day, and unbeknownst to me, my mom had kept a scrapbook. I cut out all the newspaper stuff from the whole time I was a drug police, and gave it to me. So I had that for some reference points. And I found out you just have to sit down and pound it out. It take dedicated 2 or 3 hours every day for about 10 months and came up with it. Then sent it off to the publisher and the editor. And then me and the editor lady probably went back and forth for another 2 or 3 months, just agreeing on language. And because she'd be like, well, that's street language. I said, well, that's how people talk on the street. You know, that's how real life is. It might not be exact proper English, but that's how the world is.
Did writing, well, first of all, I thought, man, you must have a brain like a vault to remember all the details. But now I understand if your mom saved all those newspaper articles, because I can't remember all those cases.
No, I went to lunch here recently. I was in Charleston and met Mike Carey, who used to be the U.S. attorney, and Jack Kessler, one of the assistants. And Mike Carey said, did you take all those case files home with you? I said, no, man. I said, my mother came up with that stuff from newspaper clippings. I said, I couldn't remember that stuff on my own.
Yeah.
I said, heck, that's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of different things to remember.
It is.
But it would just trigger things and bring things back to my memory. So,
well, did it bring back any memories that you'd rather have forgotten?
I think it helped me get rid of a lot of things I wanted to forget, really.
Excellent.
I went through a period of when we moved down here of having some PTSD-type dreams, and I don't have those anymore. So it's helped me a lot, I think. I think it helped me getting it out of my system and putting it in writing. I think that really helped me a lot. At least I think it did. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I feel better.
Well, yeah, you know what goes on in your brain, and it sounds like it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
What is it that you hope people take away from reading your book?
Oh, gosh. I hope they take away a sense to try to appreciate what the police are actually out there trying to do for. Most people don't have a clue what people working undercover or working drug cases or those type investigations go through, or what their life is like, or how hard it is. It's not easy, and having a successful case is hard. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of dedication. There's a lot of surveillance that goes into things. And sometimes it's mundane, boring stuff that you do. It's not all the I want to go buy a kilo of Coke today off of Billy Bob. If you get to there, there's a lot went into it before you got to that point in time.
Right. All right. And I highly recommend you folks try out that book. It's Snowstorm, and we'll talk about it here at the end. Just to lighten things up here a little bit, Terry, I mentioned to you, we've got a section that I've started here in the last several episodes called Rapid Fire. And this came from a follower, an avid follower of the Game of Crimes, especially over on the Patreon channel, Rick Jacobson. So I'd like to give Rick a shout out for this. We call him Rapid Fire Rick because I have a Patreon channel, which is patreon.com/gameofcrimes, everybody. But one of the things that I do is the Q&A section every month. And I haven't gotten that one out. I'm way behind on it right now. But Rick always takes the time to send me good questions, and then he includes a rapid fire section. So I've incorporated into the regular Game of Crimes. So these are designed to be one word or just short answers.
Okay.
First up, what's your favorite patrol car?
Dodge 440.
Nice. Real nice. We never had those. How about most reliable firearm?
6-hour 9mm.
I'm with you. Best undercover vehicle?
Ford pickup truck.
Yep. Like that. Worst undercover disguise?
Poodle perm haircut.
Well, I wasn't expecting to hear that. It's not something you hear every day. How about best police movie?
Oh, gosh. I like Donnie Brasco.
There you go. Joe Pistone.
I like it.
He's a legend and a hero. How about the worst police movie?
One where nobody goes to jail.
Go. One criminal you underestimated.
Some kid selling pot.
Most valuable police skill.
Relatability.
Best surveillance snack. Not beer.
Cheetos.
Your most embarrassing undercover moment.
Gosh. Getting a nickname Fat Mexican.
Okay. All right. Your most dangerous warrant.
Any crack case.
And best partner nickname. I think we just heard that one.
Well, I had a few. I had Bobo, The Nut. I had a lot of good ones.
Was those all directed at you?
No, that was all them. That was all them.
Yeah. Day shift or night shift?
Both.
One piece of advice for rookie narcotics detectives.
Oh, gosh. Don't be overzealous. Take it slow.
Very good advice. Most satisfying conviction.
Oh, gosh. Probably the guy that killed my stepson. We got him for a kilo of crack coming in from New York.
Very good. And last one, describe your career in 5 words or less.
Exciting, satisfying, enjoyable. Wouldn't recommend it for kids.
That's good advice. That really is. All right. So that's our rapid fire section. That was good because some of the answers can get where they're wordy.
Yeah, I'll try to get them as short as I could, but some of them were I couldn't.
I appreciate that. If you could open one criminal investigation that you worked on, what would that one be?
It's an old cold case. When I was in patrol division, a lady had got murdered on the west side. It's never been solved. Miss Glover, I think she was killed by two or three junkies back in the early 70s. And that case has never been solved. That was a very brutal murder. I'd like to see that case solved, but I don't think it ever will.
Yeah. So we mentioned this a little bit earlier. How important is dark humor in surviving in the law enforcement field?
Very. That's one way to let off steam, frustration, just to try to lighten the mood, because you deal with so much darkness. You see, I don't want to see any more dead people. I don't want to see any more people get hurt or people get shot. I had two informants get murdered downtown Charleston by 5 guys. I don't want to see any more of those bullet-ridden bodies. Don't want to see any more. So police made jokes to try to get through. Basically, you weren't trying to hurt anybody's feelings. You were trying to, for yourself, I think, your own self well-being. Best way I could put it.
How important is it playing pranks on each other in law enforcement?
It happened every day. Every day. Somebody was always getting somebody. Didn't matter what happened or who you were. Didn't matter.
Then you can't take it personal.
No. That's the way you knew everybody loved you.
Yes.
Exactly. If they're running a game on you.
Exactly. So why did you retire or decide to retire when you finally did?
I ended up in the projects, and I started out in the projects. I ended up back where I started, and I liked it. But after 26 and a half years, some of the fun had went out of it, and I didn't feel like I was in control of my own destiny anymore. I had a new chief and a new mayor, and I was just tired of all that game, and it was just time for me to leave. Plus, I could get my pension at that point in time and move on and do some other things.
It seems like you get to a point in your career where you're almost working for free.
That's about where I was, yes, absolutely. It's not worth it.
So, let's say your grandchildren or maybe their children read your book, Snowstorm, someday. What is it that you hope they understand about your career?
Oh, gosh, I hope they understand I did my best. I try to do my best every day, try to solve the drug problem, try to help people. That's what you're doing. You're helping people. If you're taking drugs off the street, you're helping somebody's kid that's an addict, or if somebody that has a drug problem, slowing down the product that's on the streets.
I'm with you, brother. I think we took that oath to protect and defend and lived up to the oath.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing, like I said earlier, doing the right thing all the time. It's not the easiest thing every day, but you have to do it.
I just remember one part of the book that I wanted to ask you about. What do you think about dirty cops?
I don't think much about them. We probably ended up, I counted them up again the other day. I think we did, we're involved in cases involving six Charleston policemen, a couple deputy sheriffs, and one state policeman. So, I mean, there was probably involved around 10 or 12 cops. We did a lot of cases, did not a lot, but if they run out in front of you, what are you going to do? If, you know, one, most of them were by, we weren't out looking for them, but don't get involved in the drug business and expect us to look the other way.
Right.
So, I mean, there were some, they were just tangentially involved in cases we were working, and that was their problem. That's the way I always looked at it. It was their problem. Usually offered them a deal to resign and agree not to be the police anymore, and you won't go to jail. But unfortunately, the ones I dealt with usually were too hard-headed to take that deal and ended up in jail of their own making. I mean, they could have walked away. So I don't know what to say about that. I really don't think about them. They were just, they weren't meant to have the job to start with.
Right.
They were a mistake. It was it's one of the 10 deadly management mistakes, negligent hiring. And that's what happens when you end up with those kind of people. They weren't properly vetted.
Yeah. I'm of the opinion that you drop everything and go after the dirty cop because they make us all look bad. People stereotypes cops to start with. You do. Every profession has bad apples. And when it's a police officer, it taints the entire police profession. So I'm fine with dropping everything, going after them and put them under the jail, not in the jail.
Well, it's the 10% rule. I found out whether it's cops or whether I was running the airport, 10% of the people shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
They're there, but they shouldn't be there. I'll put it that way.
I'm with you. So if you had it to do all over again, is there anything that you'd change?
I might slow my roll a little bit. I'd slow down a little bit. I wouldn't have, I like to say I wouldn't have lived on the job like I did, but I don't know if I could get that out of me. It'd be hard. It's just given my personality. Very competitive. I don't even want to lose a game of checkers to a kid. You know, so no, I'm not. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'd like to say I would slow my roll and not live on the job, but I probably would have done, I'd still do it all over just like I did it.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear.
It was too much fun. It was dangerous fun. I'll just put it that way. You were looking for, I think subconsciously you were looking for that next adrenaline rush, which is the next buy bust or the next knock the door down. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It becomes an addiction.
You can't beat the, you can't beat that excitement, that moment, that, I don't know, 30 seconds or whatever you want to call it. It's just what it is.
Right. I know it's a lot of friends, when you talk to them and they say, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? Because it was exciting. And they're like, but they've got guns. They're shooting at you. And I said, I know until you've lived it, you don't understand it. I'm sure it's the same with our military professionals that are out there. Why do they continue to re-up and put themselves in harm's way? It's a little bit different in law enforcement because I interviewed an operator, former Navy SEAL recently. His episode will be out in, let's see, yeah, it comes out next week, as a matter of fact, Kevin Kent. Well, I'm sorry, yours comes out. By the time yours comes out, it will have already been out. But Kevin talked about how, yeah, it's dangerous being in the SEALs, but you train for months and years at a time, and then you deploy for 3 months to 6 months. And then it is during that deployment, it's life or death every day. But then you come back and you train again. And he was comparing that to law enforcement, where in law enforcement, you're out there every day dealing with it. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not putting our military operators, our people that protect our country down at all. I'm so proud of everything that they do. Just trying to compare that to law enforcement. I read a study, Terry, that you may be familiar with recently, where it talked about the number of traumatic events the normal person in the United States goes through in a lifetime. And the typical person will go through between 4 and 6 traumatic events. But when you look at law enforcement, first responders, and it did not have a classification for military in there, but law enforcement and first responders, their number falls between 400 and 600 traumatic events in a lifetime. So that's why, and why I've said that before on here, I'm not throwing it out as a badge of honor. I'm just saying that until you've gone through this, just like what Terry just told you, it's hard to understand why people would commit to do this job every day when they know they could be seriously injured or killed.
Yeah, one thing I've thought about since being out of that game is maybe you shouldn't be allowed to be a policeman until you're almost 30 years old, to where you're a little more mature, to where you don't see all that bad that you see in your early 20s that's going to affect you later on. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying? To where it kind of, you're more of a mature person as opposed to a young kid seeing all that noise, as I would call it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you could get older people that whose frontal lobe has completely developed to do some of the things.
Well, that's true. That's a good point. Like one of the old guys told me, you need to get up front on this search work because you young guys will heal a little quicker.
Yeah, you know, I mean, as I got older and you start taking the promotions and the advancement, and you're looking at the guys going out and you're getting on up there in the age, you're thinking this what they're doing is a young man's game.
You're right.
So let's see here. I'm going to let you go here in just a second, Terry, but I ask this of every guest I have on here, and I do it because you have the experience and the wisdom and the expertise. So do you have any words of advice or wisdom for anyone that's considering a job in law enforcement, in the military, or maybe any high-risk occupation?
Yeah, just make sure that's what you want to do. And if you're going to do it, then you just need to totally dedicate yourself to doing it and go all in. If you don't go all in, that's when you're going to get hurt. You just have to train and make sure you're totally prepared for every situation, to where you're going to react in the right way and do the right thing. Without the training, you're not going to.
There is. So I'm trying to, I just thought of this question, but were you ever called a public servant?
Not that I can recall. I was called a lot of things, but not that. I've been effed by some of the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And I still get it here on the podcast. Love you folks out there. But as a career police officer, that's what you were, as a public servant, right?
Sure. Sure.
And I think this is Murph's opinion, everybody. And you've heard, the longtime listeners have heard this before, but I wear that as a badge of honor, because in my book, the fact that you chose to serve your fellow man, there is no higher calling than that, that you're willing to risk your own safety and potentially your life for people you don't even know, for people who want to defund you, who hate you because you represent authority and law enforcement. But yet when they need help, who do they call? They call 911. So I think it's just, I guess that's why I'm so proud to have this show and to have heroes like you, Terry, come on here I'm so glad that Jimmy made the introduction for us. Thank you again, Jimmy, and I'll be in touch. This led to reaching out to Gary Sheridan again. I hadn't talked to him in several years and just reestablishing contact there. So I guess that's it. There's another question I thought of, and it's just not coming to my brain right now, which I'll let it just part out. Is there? Well, before I let you go, Terry, is there anything that you want to talk about that I haven't brought up?
Not that I can think of. I want to thank you for having me on your program here. I appreciate it very much. And like you said, I was glad to hear from Jimmy Balcom, and hope to hear from Gary Sheridan sometime in the future. But I still have a great relationship with all the guys I used to work with, and I wouldn't trade that for anything, really. It's been great. I appreciate you.
No, thank you very much, sir. And it's truly an honor to have you on here on the show. I think that's one of the side benefits of law enforcement when you retire is you don't miss the aggravation. You do miss parts of the job, but you really miss the camaraderie that goes along with it.
Yeah, that's one thing. Like you mentioned earlier, I had two or three jobs after I left the police department, and every one of them I tried to create that same camaraderie that I had as a police officer, and you can't do it because you're not taking a chance on getting killed with those people at the airport or the tax department or wherever you work. You don't have that bond that you have with cops.
Right. And then you just jog my memory. I was trying to think of a question, everybody, I forgot. What are you doing now in retirement?
Nothing. Just my wife, Linda, and I, we work out 4 or 5 days a week and hang out here at the house, go around different places here in Florida, go watch the grandson play baseball. He's playing baseball down here. He's 11, almost 12. So he's like dealing with a grown adult now. Of course, he knows everything. So anyway, hang out with him, my son and his wife, and just enjoying life. Go visit relatives up in North Carolina, my other son and my sister and my mom and everybody. So just enjoying life.
Excellent. That's the way it should be. You've earned it, brother.
Yeah, thank you.
And your family has too. That's one thing I did fail to mention is our unsung heroes, our families that put up with everything that we go through, that we put them through, that we expect them to be there when we come home because we've been out doing God's work. But they're as big of heroes as anybody that's put on a uniform.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And that's one thing I always try to do is never take the job to the house. I try to leave it. Never take it home.
All right, everybody. So if you'd like to find out more about Mr. Terry Sayer here, the only place you can find him on social media is on Facebook. And his first name is T-E-R-R-Y. Last name is S-A-Y-R-E, not E-R, S-A-Y-R-E. Or you can find him on LinkedIn at Terry Sayer as well. His book is Snowstorm, Police, Politics, and Cocaine. You're seeing a placard up here now for those of you on YouTube. You can find this book on Amazon. I found it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Thrift Books. And I'm sure there's a few other places that I wasn't able to find. But if you're interested in old-time law enforcement, like I said yesterday, basic narcotics investigations 101 and how they can escalate into some major cases, on how law enforcement deals with the wonderful politicians that are out there that always have our backs, not. This is the book you want to read. It's one of those when you pick it up, and I say this about every book I read, it seems like, but it's hard to put down once you start. So thank you so much for continuing to come back to the Game of Crimes every week. I know I couldn't do any of this without your support. I do appreciate it. I don't understand you. I don't understand why you come back, but I believe it's because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And what's that? That's our Game of Crimes. God bless you all. I'll see you next week.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino.